so am I still waiting, waiting a long time,
waiting for tonight.
Listen to Rivulube.
Oh, no.
Here we go.
Undertaker.
We told you somebody's going to get hurt. This is it.
No. No. Tombstone pile driver on the steel steps. We're going to crown a new champion. Here's the cover. Here's Terry. Wait.
Michael, there's no way to stop this.
Edge with a steel chair. A concerto. A thunderous concerto.
The entrance got to count.
Edge threw in Batista over the fallen Undertaker. Batista had no clue.
Mickey Hudson has no choice.
Batista retains the title.
Not like this.
Welcome to Review Away. I am John Pollock, joined as always by Wei Ting.
My name.
How are you, Wei? You literally just finished watching the 2007 Survivor Series. It's fresh. It's like, this is like an episode of The Law, where immediately after the main event, you're now going to go and talk about it for 2 hours.
Yeah, I kind of like that. I kind of don't...
It's immediate. Prefer. You're not going to have to think of, what did I watch? I watched Survivor Series days ago at this point.
Yeah, it's in my system, and then I just flush it right out, and then that's it.
Yeah, it's like a big meal.
Yeah.
And now this podcast represents going to the bathroom.
Yeah.
Essentially. So thank you for downloading the excrements. And hopefully you can sift through and find what you need within it.
That's a very...
great analogy.
Yeah, that's very flattering. Thank you.
We have a guest on today's show. Are you excited?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
What? Who is it?
We are going to be joined by Dave Meltzer.
Whoa.
From November of 2007 on The Law.
Whoa. So this will be Wrestling Observer...
This is going to be Retro Observer Extra with Dave Meltzer, where we're going to get his thoughts... when he first watched this pay-per-view, and before he flushed it outside.
Right. Wonderful.
So we will hear him from The Law from November 18th of 2007.
We were probably both there.
We were. You would have called him right before.
Yeah. But I have no recollection of this show.
See, because you flushed it out of your mind.
Yeah.
And had to rewatch it.
Yeah.
So we're going to chat about that. How are you doing, Wei? I see you have a coffee. I've got an energy drink.
Coffee and energy. You know what? It definitely makes a difference for me in my life.
Where's that coffee from, this particular?
It's from the little shop across the street.
Give some love to the local business. Do you know what it's called?
I don't even know what it's called. Market Bistro or something?
Okay.
It's okay. It's just coffee.
Yeah.
Anyway, coffee for me actually makes a difference not only in, you know, when I watch these shows to help me stay awake, not only when I, you know, do these podcasts to bring my energy up. So, you know, this is me at a 10 right now.
But people like that about you. I'm the asshole that complains about everything, and Wei gives the common man's view.
But that, what is that? The, nothing to do with my energy level. I'm just a naturally
you're
laid
the
back.
Calm one.
Okay. But anyway, it makes a difference just in my daily interaction, too. I had a colleague of mine remark to me the other day, that Wei has two levels, energetic and non-energetic. And I guess I really notice it myself, too, where if I'm not energetic, I simply just don't want to talk to anybody. I don't want to do anything.
Oh, good. It's not just me.
Yeah. But you're usually full of energy.
I do, but I definitely have times where, I just want to be... isolated.
Yeah.
I think everyone's like that deep down.
It's a big difference.
But some people admit it and some don't.
Yeah, but when I drink a coffee, I'm like, it's like I'm, It's definitely like cocaine for me.
Yeah, only it's
illegal.
It's more addictive.
More addictive? I don't know about that. I've never done cocaine.
So. Neither have I, so I can't really speak to it. But yeah. I love coffee. I love waking up in the morning knowing that I'm going to get a coffee to start my day. It's like stretching.
Really?
Before
you
a big run.
You love it that much?
I do. I look forward to having a coffee in the morning.
Wow. Okay. I mean,
I'm currently sick right now. When I'm sick, I don't feel like drinking coffee.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of going through withdrawal.
Right. See, I like feeling the buzz that I still feel, and I worry that if I were to drink coffee every day, I mean, it would sort of weaken its effects on
it. It probably does.
Yeah.
Because so I don't necessarily get, like, this jolt from coffee. I think most of it's mental.
You think so?
I think most of it is just... exactly. I think that there's some extent to that, because your body is just used to it.
Why don't we experiment? Why don't, like, one day I'll bring you your coffee. I'll bring you your coffee for maybe, like, a week. And then one of those days, I'll just put it in, like...
You could be giving me decaf.
Yeah.
I wonder if decaf, if there would be a noticeable drop-off, or if it would just be... It would still... Your mind would still take to it as if it was...
And then I'll ask you, hey, John, did you experience any difference in one of those days? And then I don't know what you'll say, but the trick is, all the coffees would be decaf.
Oh.
Ah.
Tricky motherfucker. See? Have you ever been addicted to anything in your life? Like, addicted.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure I have. I'm trying to think.
When I was younger, if I got into, like, a video game, I would just go nuts at it. But then it was, like, cold turkey, like, I don't want to ever play this game again.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely with video games, they're highly addictive. They should come with a warning.
Yeah.
Like a smoker's label.
I got Roller Coaster Tycoon for my computer once. I played that thing to death for, like, 3 straight weeks. Wow. I just wanted to up my profit margins so high, you know... Build up umbrella stands and pray that it would rain.
Right. I used to be really addicted to just watching television.
Yeah.
You know, like, I used to be, like, when I was a kid, I would just be the type to just sit on my couch. And even sometimes today, where, like, if I find myself just sitting in front of a couch, it's impossible to get up. And, like, when I was a kid, like, during summers without school, I'd spend, like 10 hours... in front of a TV.
Consecutively?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like, not moving, not doing anything. I'd eat in front of the TV, and it would just, like, my body would just be, like, festering with sweat and...
Get up and do something.
Yeah, but it's just, like... I mean, I didn't even want to watch anything on TV, but you're just, like, stuck there wanting to channel surf. And anyway, now I really don't watch any TV.
You would think that... If people are addicted to television, it would be more so a case. Now, like, you're talking about a time when you'd have to, like, maybe sit through commercials and stuff.
Yeah.
Now, it's like everything's on demand.
Right.
You could sit there for 10 hours, and there's no commercials to worry about. Well, you can watch whatever you want.
Yeah, but I think now a lot of maybe TV... I'm sure people still get, you know, addicted to whatever. But I think that's even more replaced now these days with just an internet addiction.
You know, I definitely think
whether
that's...
Whether it be Facebook or whatever else, just sitting in front of your computer becomes so habitual and difficult.
I think my biggest addiction would be if I find some new hobby or something, like some kind of thing that involves buying things, I just want everything of some subset. Like, I've talked about my eBay craze, the fateful months of 2003, where I got on eBay for the first time, and I found all these old wrestling tapes, and suddenly I had in my mind, I'm going to get every pay-per-view ever produced. That was my goal.
Yeah.
And it was like, all this shit would come in the mail. It's like, I wouldn't even sit down and watch these.
Yeah.
I guarantee you, of those tapes I bought during that summer, I have watched maybe 30% of them.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted them. It was a challenge to get them all.
You're...
It was the same when I read, like, Choose Your Own Adventure. I just wanted every one. Fear Street. I wanted every book.
Like R.L. Stein?
Yeah. I used to read those when I was a kid, and they'd have a number system, and it's like, damn it, I just want to, I want the set.
That's how they get you. You can't have...
Totally.
You can't have, 1 to 15, and you're missing 11.
Oh, and it would drive me crazy.
Yeah. You know, I'm like that still almost a little with comic books. And
it's why Superior Spider-Man to me, it's like I've fallen behind on issues, but like it's in the back of my head that it's like, I have to go back to where I stopped and read all of them. I couldn't just pick up now 5 issues removed. I need to read them all.
And I will say, perhaps with comic books, like, it's a tactic that they rely on.
Sure.
More than some other things to get people to purchase their things, because numbering is just such a... It's so weird, but the way numbering works in comic books is it's so gimmicky, but you have, you know, legions of fans that rely on these things, and legions of fans that, you know, have that sort of OCD type of mentality where, oh, shit, you know, I'm missing a number, I gotta get that number. And I've very much fallen into that trap where, you know, just like you, I buy a lot, and I don't even read everything. I just, like, you just crave it. You just, like, you need this thing to make you happy. And I think, you know, I think sometimes you just have to step back and realize, you know, how beneficial is this thing, for me.
How many people out there do you think, Wei, own all 27 editions of the Survivor Series and maybe are missing 2007?
On VHS?
Just in general, whatever means.
DVD?
The 27th Survivor Series was this past weekend.
See, but it's weird to own some things on VHS and then some things on DVD.
You need a consistent platform.
I believe so.
Yes.
And are all 27 Survivor Series released on DVD?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, then it's an incomplete collection.
So you need to have them all on VHS or DVD.
So just give up.
Give up. You're not going to. Just download our shows when they become available. This is the only... MP3 is the best version.
That's right.
To have recaps of.
How many people do you think collect every episode of all this bullshit that's coming out of our mouths?
More than I think you would imagine. I've heard from people who it's like they've showed me their library setup. They've renamed stuff. They have every show of ours cataloged.
It's very flattering.
It's like at lawradio.proboards.com in the episode archives where you have... both a chronological timeline as well as when we have recorded the shows. So you can go back and you can just start a beautiful 1985 and just work your way up to the present of all the shows we've done.
We should just, like, fuck them up somehow. Like, maybe we'll number a show but date it in the past and then...
What a mean person.
Or maybe just skip a number for no reason. Let's just skip by 10. So whatever the episode number this is.
You have these dedicated listeners that have a formula, and you just want to mess with them.
Listen, I'm just trying to break this collector's mentality that I think ultimately can be unhealthy.
Well, we want people to collect our shows, I don't think we want to turn people off.
That is true. But, I mean, as long as, you know, you guys can hear it and enjoy it for a time. I mean, I wonder, even people that collect it, like, what's the point of collecting? This show, actually, you know what, you should collect it, because who knows how long these shows will be up.
Do you go back and collect all our shows, and do you listen to yourself?
No, I don't even download them. I mean, the way I stream...
It's kind of weird to be listening to yourself.
No, I do listen occasionally.
I try to sometimes, because I want to listen to myself and what I don't like about what I do. Words I say over and over again.
What have you noticed?
Well, definitely people have pointed out the absolutely.
I haven't noticed that.
Right now, we're going to review the Survivor Series coming up right now. That is mental. Like, whenever I write scripts, anything, I never want to repeat words.
That one I have noticed.
Right now.
But I don't think that's too bad.
You're right. It's not too bad.
No, it's not too bad.
Let us get into the Survivor Series. I consider this the waiting glory period of watching pay-per-views, back when you were forced to, when you were our call screener.
You mean I'm not forced to right now?
You're not. You don't have to.
I wasn't forced to back then either.
No, you kind of did it on your own volition.
Yeah, I was just working on the law. But I wasn't really following everything as closely as I am today, obviously.
This Survivor Series, going into it, actually, one of the big stories they were dangling was it was 10 years since the Montreal Screwjob. Mm-hmm. And earlier that year... when they killed off Vince McMahon, they got Brett to do a taped vignette at the time where, you know, people from Vince's past would give out messages about why Vince McMahon was a horrible person, and it was on the Raw that led up to his limo exploding. So there were people thinking, are they going to do something on this 10th anniversary of the Montreal Screwjob and what they're going to do in it? Brett's kind of in this weird place right now. He had gone into the Hall of Fame, and that's what I recall from this time. In fact, I think I interviewed Brett on the afternoon of this Survivor Series, and it might have aired that night on The Law.
When was he in the Hall of Fame?
2006.
Okay.
But he was not at that time willing to do angles and stuff like that. So it was kind of interesting at this point. As well, this was 2007, so we were only a few months removed from the Chris Benoit murder-suicide deal.
Yeah.
So I always kind of had this shadow over this time period because that tragedy really, to me, kind of like blanketed this whole time period. When I think 2007, particularly the second half, that's all I remember really, is that this was post Benoit. Mm-hmm. And there were actually, I'll find out if you noticed, there was not one but two Chris Benoit references on this particular pay-per-view.
I definitely noticed one. I'm trying to think of the other.
Well, it will come up. The show started with an opening video looking at 20 years of the Survivor Series. Of course, it had started in November of 1987 as a pay-per-view just designed to mess with the NWA with their Starrcade event that night from Chicago and go head-to-head with them and kind of pressure the cable systems out of running the Starrcade event. And if you want to hear more about that, you can check our review of the Glory Days, the Jim Crockett Promotions documentary we reviewed a couple of weeks back. But they show some old clips and then into the main matches, which tonight will feature The Undertaker challenging Batista for the world title, a feud that, quote, has left both men void of feeling. So you would think they'd be invincible to pain here.
Hey, I think I left my notes in my computer. Can I just
let's take an intermission, everybody, as Wei is void of notes. I'm gonna leave all this in.
Hey, sorry, man.
No problem.
The internet is just a mess.
And we're back on the show. Wei just left for 39 minutes. You had to rewatch half the pay-per-view.
I just...
On 4-speed.
It was the internet.
Well, Wei is back. He's got his notes. Now we will officially begin the review of Survivor Series 2007. And Wei, tonight's song was The Hives. Tick, tick, boom.
Uh-huh.
Were you a fan of this song? I kind of like The Hives.
Yeah. Yeah, I did too. I kind of had fallen out, though, with them. I mean, I'd say of all the wrestling pay-per-view theme songs that they've ever had, I'm just, you know...
Upbeat, just, energetic.
Yeah, probably one of the better bands.
We also had a big chainsaw theme to this, to the poster. It was weird. The poster featured Edge, who is out at this time, injured. So he hadn't been on TV for months, and he was featured on the poster carrying a chainsaw. And then all the graphics were these chainsaws coming out.
Was Saw a big movie back then?
Well, the first Saw came out in 2004, I want to say. And it came out every October there was a Saw movie. So there would have been one in 2007.
Are there chainsaws in Saw? I've never even saw Saw.
You haven't seen Saw?
No, I haven't saw Saw.
You haven't seen Saw or saw Saw?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's... If you swore, I would have said you're being saucy. I'm sure there were chains in Saw. Chainsaws in Saw. Fuck. Oh, my God. The point was, we didn't see a Saw in this fucking paper. What the fuck are we talking about? Anyway, Joey Styles and Taz opened the show.
Yeah.
They were doing ECW at the time, so they were brought in here to do this opening match. ECW champion CM Punk against The Miz and John Morrison. Miz and Morrison were a tag team at this point. They were holding the tag titles, and so we had the idea that these two were going to try and work together with one of them getting the title against the babyface CM Punk, who was a very different CM Punk. I mean, just kind of like your fresh-faced babyface at this point on ECW, the young upstart.
This was like such a far cry from what this man is today. Like, back then, he's just, like you said, a generic baby face.
He would come out smiling and punching
the crowd,
to the air. And
not much attitude. Did the Wanderlei Silva thing, which couldn't really pull off.
So, The match was not bad here. Miz and Morrison, they double-teamed Punk.
Can I just say, the build-up for this, they did an angle on ECW where they had Miz and Morrison basically both attack Punk, and each would take turns one-upping each other with what they could do to CM Punk. And I can't imagine them doing anything like this with CM Punk today.
Miz.
With any babyface that they really care about. You know, basically.
Oh, I could absolutely see them doing this kind of thing, and right. But not with Punk.
That they care about is what
yeah.
I mean.
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, what a way to treat, you know, anybody, but especially somebody like CM Punk who must have had a huge fit over something like this.
Did you follow much ECW at the time, this incarnation?
No, not at all.
It would air like Friday nights at midnight here in Canada on Global, and it was... I'd watch it every week, and it really just, it became much closer to, like, what NXT is today.
Sure.
Like, that's really what
sure,
it was.
That was the idea.
And they had their champion, and, I mean, it also kind of, it was not as under the microscope of the WWE. It was kind of, they did have at least some more freedoms to get some different acts across and see what would work. And, I mean, if you were interested in seeing kind of the next wave of people, as they brought up Sheamus and other talents like that, getting a sense of them in front of crowds, but not really, you know, under the same focus as, like, Raw or even SmackDown at that
time.
We
should review... Well, we did review the ECW pay-per-view, right?
Oh, December to not remember.
Yeah.
Yeah, not a... That's a... Not the best way to encapsulate ECW. Or maybe it was. Maybe for some that is the perfect representation of the attempt to reboot ECW. So anyway, early on in the match, they're working over Punk, and Punk tosses both of them to the floor and then hits a suicide dive and gets up and yells, "What's my name?" More stuff you'd never hear CM Punk do now, you would assume. Miz and Morrison, they got the advantage back. They were double-teaming Punk. There was a back and neck breaker combination by Morrison to Punk after he swung over the top and knocked Miz to the floor. Punk went to skin the cat, but then Miz pulls his legs and Punk lands on the floor. And then Morrison comes off the top with a split-legged corkscrew delivered to the Miz.
This was the debut of the Starship Pain.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And then Punk... went for a top rope Hurricane Rana to Morrison, and then it was turned into a powerbomb by Miz upon landing as he caught Morrison coming down. It was a great spot, and people are kind of torn with John Morrison. He was like this unbelievable, like, gymnast that could do some stuff flawlessly. But on the other side, it would be like this guy... There was some disconnect because it came across like this guy was performing rather than he's in a fight.
Right.
And I think, like, and he also just didn't have a certain personality that connected
like,
with people.
Like, I think you see that a lot with the people that were super athletic, like you know, like an RVD or even like somebody like a Kofi Kingston or a Dolph Ziggler, which I've pointed out in the past where they do a lot of things that are maybe physically impressive, but they don't look realistic.
Right, and that was the case here with Morrison. I mean, some incredibly impressive stuff here. That Hurricane Rana into the powerbomb spot looked
wrestling.
Really cool.
Especially, like, if you watch Lucha, the name of the game is really not even to be realistic at all. It's just to pull off athletic feats.
Miz runs at Punk, who gets out of the way, and he knocks Morrison to the floor as Punk sidesteps and then hits the GTS to Miz for the win at 7 minutes and 58 seconds. This was a good opener, I thought. And this was at a point, I mean, when the Miz first came in, I mean, I had no time for this guy. I just thought he was a complete disaster. And it was this tag team with John Morrison where he got his character across. They did the dirt sheet on WWE.com, which really allowed them to have a lot of fun and develop their personalities. And it was in this tag team that he was able to become a decent talent in the ring, where with the right guy, he could have very good matches. And it's not like The Miz is a... terrible wrestler. This was where he kind of evolved, where at first he seemed lost.
Yeah, whereas before I'd assume that he was just a celebrity from a TV show, probably, you know, not many people gave a chance to last very long, but this is probably where he seemed like an actual wrestler that belonged in this company. Do you think that he would be better served today in a tag team role?
I definitely think. I think a lot of guys could really benefit being in a tag team. Miz comes to mind. Kofi Kingston comes to mind. Curtis Axel. Guys that are not ready to be singles performers. Or in the case of Miz, there's something about
it's
Miz.
So it's funny you say that because the guy main evented WrestleMania.
I know. Yeah. I know. And I think that when people poke fun at WrestleMania headliners, I think Miz will be one of the first that comes to mind. And I don't think he's a horrible performer, but I feel he's not a super effective babyface or heel. And I think if he was kind of hidden in a role where all of the focus of a segment wasn't on him,
yeah,
I think it would be much easier. And much like Curtis Axel, I think if you had paired him with somebody, like, and a Ted DiBiase Jr. comes to mind as well, I think there's certain talents that working in a tag team, it's like not all the focus is on you, and it allows you to develop a lot of confidence. Mm-hmm. Like, look at Roman Reigns. If they brought this guy in as just this monster, like a Ryback push, I think he would have been, he's coming onto national TV, he's expected to talk, he's got to work matches on his own. It could have been a failure right out of the gate, and instead they put him in a limited role, and now they're ready to take a few steps further with the guy, and I think he's going to be better prepared for it because he's got a certain confidence level right now because he's gotten over in this role with the Shield. Mm-hmm. They go over... I apologize, everyone. My head's going to explode at some point. It's going to go tick, tick, boom. We go over to Michael Cole and JBL, the SmackDown announced team at this point, and they show a clip from television where MVP... was injuring Matt Hardy and goes after his knee after they had lost the tag titles to Miz and Morrison. And they show the big angle here. At this time, Miz was believing he was the captain of their team. And Michael Cole said the C stands for coward and not captain.
You mean MVP.
MVP, sorry. And Matt Hardy would be taken out of the traditional Survivor Series match later on in the show as a result of this angle because he was legit hurt at this point. Then, who I wrote down as random interview girl.
Yeah, who is this?
Anastasia Rose. I have zero memory of who this woman was. Mm-hmm. I had to look her up. I had to look her up to find her name. They didn't even key her. And she was off the Divas search, and she lasted like a couple of weeks, including the Survivor Series pay-per-view. And she welcomed MVP in the back, said Hardy won't be competing tonight, and holds up his U.S. title. Even in the very few questions asked, Anastasia Rose did not seem to be long for this job.
No.
I think they, you really somewhat maybe take for granted a Renee Young when you see someone like this in that spot. This is not the easiest role to pull off.
Sure. Well, or maybe she just simply didn't care for wrestling.
Well, maybe not. I guess the bloom was off Rose.
Okay.
At this point.
All right.
Hey. They announced the next match was the Women's Survivor Series match, and this crowd was very, very excited in Miami for the announcement that the Women's Elimination match was next. Mm-hmm. A far cry from this past week's Survivor Series Women's match. We had Beth Phoenix, Layla, Jillian Hall, Victoria, and Melina taking on Tori Wilson, Michelle McCool, Kelly Kelly, Maria, and Mickey James. Quite the lineup at this time in 2007.
I like these. I think these should be an annual tradition. They're sort of like class photos. So every year, you want to know who's on the Divas roster, just watch.
You put them in a match together, just to give you an update of the directory of the women. Melina comes out and does her traditional entrance.
They built this thing up, like Lawler and Cole. Lawler's like, oh, I can't wait for Melina to come out and do her entrance.
Yeah, this was where they were scaling back with Melina because she used to come out and she'd have like a skirt on where she would do the splits, and now they had moved her into tights.
Oh, okay.
So we were pulling back a little on the Melina, what we could see of Melina.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, she goes to do her big splits on the apron and just tumbles to the floor, to which Jim Ross says, oops. And then Melina gets into the ring. She fucking no-sells it. Like, just gets right back up.
She was, yeah, she was just, like, smiling, laughing at herself, and then, you know, like,
decided to do it again.
Yeah.
Which falls, because what if she had screwed it up again?
Yeah. It seemed like the Victoria was encouraging her to just go and do it again. And credit to you know, her for pulling it off, and to the producers for keeping her music going, letting her do it. They could have simply said, okay, fuck this, let's move on. She did it again, pretty much like saved herself.
Michelle McCool comes out in a Miami Heat jersey. Her gimmick is she loves life. And they would air these vignettes on SmackDown about Michelle McCool at the beach or hanging out with friends. And it was like, Michelle McCool, loving life.
Wow. I can't wait to see somebody like that wrestle.
Yeah. It would be funny because, you know, the whole gimmick was loving life and she'd marry the dead man.
Huh. They balance each other.
Yeah. This, I misspoke. This was not an elimination match. It was one fall to a finish.
Right.
And Jillian comes in, and her big spot was taking Kelly's face and planting it into her chest, and then went for a handspring elbow, but gets stopped by Kelly, who gets her feet up, as Jim Ross notes that Jillian Hall is no mudo.
Yeah.
No mudo. Mm-hmm. Maria comes in and does this cool, like, handstand into a head scissors, and then hits Jillian with, like, a heel kick. Very acrobatic. Then Maria gets a hot tag, makes a hot tag to Mickey James, who comes in with Melina, and it leads to Mickey dipping Melina and making out with her. This was like, didn't we joke about this being Bray Wyatt's finish?
Yeah.
Yeah. I had totally forgotten Mickey ever did this. Mm-hmm. And gives her a spinning wheel kick after stunning Melina by sticking her tongue in her mouth, and Mickey pins Melina at 4 minutes and 41 seconds.
To me, it was clear that Mickey was the star of this match. She was much more fluid than some of the others, and the crowd really only got going with her in here.
She was like Matt Hardy for a time, where she wasn't being pushed, but whenever she would come out, the crowd was just so into Mickey James, like push or no push.
Yeah.
She always was able to get a pretty hot reaction, no matter what her position was on the show. Then we go to Jonathan Coachman and then Commissioner of the WWE, William Regal, who are in the back, along with Hornswoggle, who had recently been revealed as Vince McMahon's child, which was originally earmarked for Mr. Kennedy, and then they switched it to Hornswoggle, and it resulted in some horrendous television. Regal is, he's getting ready for, Regal's watching on here as Hornswoggle's getting ready for his match with the Great Khali. This featured a weigh-in on SmackDown. Not even the night before, not following the Florida Athletic Commission 24 hours before. They let them weigh in two nights before. Mm-hmm. So imagine how much weight Hornswoggle put on afterwards and rehydrating.
Well, what were they supposed to cut to?
I don't know. This would be a hell of a catchweight bout.
Yeah.
I don't know where they were meeting at. And then we cut to Randy Orton. And, you know, I enjoy Randy Orton. For the most part, I like Randy Orton, and I feel sometimes I'm in the minority. But my God, this man's promo here. This is what he said. I can sense the excitement in the air. Tonight, I'm going to beat Shawn Michaels. I am the one-man dynasty. Oh my God. If ever there was a man that could put a theoretical sleeper hold on me in 30 seconds, this promo was it. What a dull promo.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like Randy Orton's a guy who is good at what he does.
But promos are not one of them.
No, but what I mean is that he's got this style, this very slow, plodding style, where he, you know, he walks out to the ring very slow, he talks slowly.
He knows his character inside and out.
Yeah, but it's like, like, that's all he's, I feel like he maybe relies on it, or maybe doesn't evolve that.
Do you feel he's too programmed?
Yeah, I don't know.
It's like, you can close your eyes and figure out a Randy Orton comeback and finish.
Yes, and especially, like, whenever he has the heat, like, even just down to 7 years ago, or 6 years ago, watching this match, it's just a very boring, formulaic style. Like, and that's not to say that, you know, it's terrible. I think it's fine, but it's very predictable, and I think, like, he's good at what he does. It's just not evolved, you know what I mean?
From there we go to Shawn Michaels in his cowboy hat, who says that Orton has made his family miserable and said he has tried to take his livelihood, so tonight he'll take the WWE title from Randy Orton. And Shawn Michaels was brought back here because, if you recall, we've reviewed No Mercy 2007, where John Cena, they vacated the title, and then this was when John Cena was out with one of many injuries, and they panicked, and they called Shawn Michaels, who was at home at the time, and they needed him to come back, so he came back for this program with Randy Orton at the time. Up next was a tag title match, the World Tag Titles. We still had two sets of tag titles during this time. Miz and Morrison had one set on SmackDown and ECW, and then Lance Cade and Trevor Murdoch were the World Tag Team Champions. And Holly and Rhodes got this title shot because they won a number one contenders match on a WWE.com exclusive match over Paul London and Brian Kendrick and the Highlanders. Mm-hmm. a WWE.com exclusive way. This is the equivalent today of, like, winning a match on the app to get a title shot.
Sure. Or the kickoff.
So Cade and Murdoch against Rhodes and Holly. Cade got draped on the ropes and kicked in the gut by Holly. Cade and Murdoch then got the heat on Holly, tagging in and out. Crowd was very quiet for this match. Holly made the hot tag to Cody, who hit a bulldog to Murdoch, a missile drop kick. Cade made the save, and then Holly comes in, clotheslines Cade to the floor, but then Murdoch hits the Canadian Destroyer for the win at 7 minutes and 18 seconds on Cody Rhodes. Not too many guys in the company that can take this finish, which made this tough for Murdoch, but I'll take this version of the Canadian Destroyer for a guy the size of Murdoch any day. I mean, it was incredible this guy could pull off that move.
Yeah, or his opponent also.
Yeah, well, yeah, it was as much on the opponent.
Yeah, he calls it the Ace of Spades, and I don't know how often he did it. Actually, I think he did it.
He did it a handful of times.
Yeah, but sometimes, though, there's this one time where he did it to Matt Hardy that just completely bombed. Like, he landed on himself more than Matt Hardy.
It's a tough move to take. I always saw something in Trevor Murdoch just because he looked different.
Yeah.
He was very good in the ring, and I really kind of enjoyed him. And unfortunately, he just didn't get a lot of interest and just kind of fizzled out in the company. Holly is upset at Cody in the ring, but then slaps his arm and takes off, and they're kind of playing the kind of odd couple tag team here with the grouchy old veteran and the young rookie in Cody Rhodes. Ross and Lawler then talk about the history of the Survivor Series, how it started 21 years ago, even though it was 20 years ago, from 87 to 2007, and they show all the announced
teams. Is that 21?
Well, 1987 to 2007. That's 20 years.
Yeah. Oh, what
Ross said 21 here.
Oh, okay.
It would have been the 21st annual Survivor Series.
I'm so confused. Anyway. So what anniversary is it?
Probably the 50th by WWE math. So for this next Survivor Series elimination match, we were going to have all six announcers call this one. Ross, Lawler, JBL, Cole, Taz, and Joey Styles.
Yeah.
Train wreck.
This was perhaps a democracy taken to its most extreme.
Very unnecessary. Yeah. We go to Todd Grisham. Todd Grisham, now of ESPN, an MMA reporter, with Triple H, Jeff Hardy.
How do you like him as an MMA reporter? He doesn't just cover MMA, though.
No, he does all sports. Okay. He covers it. I think he does a fine job.
He's more of an anchor than an actual reporter,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, he's not really, you know, your kind of
investigative journalist.
No, he's kind of just in a host role. I mean, he gets by fine. Yeah. Todd is with Triple H, Jeff Hardy, Kane, and Rey Mysterio, and they all get turns talking. Mysterio says he has always been an underdog. Kane says how we're all different and brings up the fact that tonight he's teaming with Triple H, who once accused him of murder and having sex with his dead girlfriend. Hardy then says Hunter once put him in a hospital so that Hunter gets his funny little comeback line of, "My bad, sorry." And that tonight they can put their differences aside to do something terrible to other people instead of themselves.
Mm. This was cute. I like it whenever they bring up their terrible booking from the past.
Sure. We can always use reminders of Katie Vick.
Yeah, of course.
So the elimination match here was Hunter, Kane, Mysterio, and Hardy against Mr. Kennedy, Finlay, Big Daddy V, MVP, and Umaga. Mm-hmm. Umanga, as William Regal would call him. So it was 5-on-4 here with the injury to Matt Hardy, and we have all the announcers calling this one. Crowd, you could tell, very much into Jeff Hardy here, and this was a full year before they would put the title on him. Big Daddy V is in with Kane and hit this belly-to-belly for a two count, and they clearly here were really pushing Big Daddy V on ECW. And Kane chokeslams Finlay and then goes into a Samoan drop by V, and then Big Daddy V hits the dreaded elbow drop to eliminate Kane at 5.5 minutes. And this elbow drop way was just the elbow drop of doom.
Sure, I mean,
guys losing to an elbow drop.
I mean, The Rock.
Yeah, this was not the people's elbow, though. This was...
I don't mind it, though, when it's a guy that big. Yeah. And all his weight behind it.
He was just a gigantic, like, train wreck of a looking man. Big Daddy V. Just falling out of this, like, Abdullah the Butcher outfit.
It's just interesting to me because this guy's been in your company for 10 years, more than 10 years, and they realized, what's going to get this guy over? Let's show his giant six pairs of tits. Tattoo.
Arm fat.
Yeah. And I think it worked for a time.
Maybe on a small scale.
He's certainly more over here than he was as Mabel or Viscera.
Mysterio is getting stomped on by Umaga, then misses a seated splash, hits the 619, and then a springboard seated senton for a two count. Crowd was really into that. Then Umaga caught Rey off the ropes and hit his black hole slam and a Samoan spike to pin Mysterio. The heels are then working over Jeff Hardy, who hit a twist of fate to MVP out of nowhere to eliminate MVP. Hunter gets out of the way as Big Daddy V elbow drops Kennedy, and then Hunter pins Kennedy at 14 and a half minutes. Big Daddy V then caught Jeff Hardy, sent him into the steel post back first. They hit a double DDT to Big Daddy V, so Hunter eliminates him. And then it's down to Hunter and Hardy against Finley and Umaga. Hardy gets kicked by Umaga and takes a back bump off the apron to the floor and comes back with a whisper in the wind to fit Finley. Hunter goes in for a pedigree to Finley, but Umaga kicks him. And then Hunter blocks the Celtic Cross, hits a pedigree to eliminate him, and it comes down to Hunter pedigreeing Umaga and Hardy with the follow-up Swanton to pin Umaga, and Hunter and Jeff Hardy are your sole survivors at 22 minutes and 9 seconds.
I thought this was a good match. I really was impressed with the... Well, first of all, Rey Mysterio, I think, is great. He had some excellent chemistry in there with Umaga, and Umaga himself, too, was awesome. A very stiff, aggressive style that I wonder, you know, probably looked pretty snug.
One of my favorite combinations, especially at that time period, was anytime Jeff Hardy and Umaga worked together.
Yeah.
They were just so excellent for one another. Like, just tremendous.
Yeah.
I think Umaga had a huge part in why Jeff Hardy caught on with people so much. You had, you know, the size disparity, and he was just such a great base for all of Hardy's offense.
Yeah.
I mean, those two, if you go back and watch some of their matches, they were tremendous.
I thought Hunter and Jeff Hardy themselves did great, too. So, good match.
Shaquille O'Neal is shown in the crowd. This was back when he was still part of the Miami Heat. And then we go back to Coachman, Regal, and Hornswoggle in the back, and Vince McMahon walks in. Hornswoggle grabs onto his leg, and Vince explains that he made this match with the Great Khali because Hornswoggle's last name is McMahon, and not because he doesn't like the little guy. McMahon always rises to the occasion, he says. He says, "I was an underdog against Time Warner and the U.S. government," and then says, "I might have to beat them again," in reference to the congressional hearings that were about to go underway, coming off of the Chris Benoit deal and a look into steroid use.
So that was the first
reference. That was the first reference.
Gotcha.
And then says, "I was also an underdog that time in Pakistan." And he says, "That's another subject. I have no clue what he was talking about."
Hmm.
No clue. If anybody knows, please, post.
Yeah.
And
Was Court working on the team?
He had left. I thought he was still here at this time, but no, Court left, I think, in July of this year.
I see.
And then says that McMahons have big balls and we stick together, which I don't know if I would have used that particular phrase right after. Big balls and sticking together. It was kind of weird. Anyway.
What was the point? The point of this was, I guess, to tease the upcoming match, but... It just felt more like an excuse for Vince to kind of give his family rally cry.
This was like Vinny on Total Divas this past week, just, you know, having Arian talk about his big dick.
Right.
It's painful.
Oh, they're booking Vinny very, very well on that show.
They showed a tale of the tape for these two, Khali and Hornswoggle. And then out of nowhere, Shane McMahon comes out. Hadn't been on TV for a while, just comes out with that Shane McMahon dance we all love. And then he announces his father, Vince McMahon, who comes out. And then his little brother, Hornswoggle McMahon. And they explain this is the first time Shane and Hornswoggle have been together on television. A monumental Survivor Series moment.
Just hearing you say those words and putting those images back in my mind from watching this, it gives me a headache just to even think about
it. I'm sorry.
That, this whole thing. Hornswoggle McMahon. What a terrible, terrible idea.
I have zero memory. Like, when I put on the Survivor Series, like, I had no idea about this match. I have no recollection of it. Nothing. Nothing stood out about this at all going into this show.
What do you think they were going to go with Kennedy in this role?
they had big plans for Kennedy. I mean, he was, I mean, this wasn't going to be some comedy role for Kennedy. He was going to be the son of Vince McMahon.
What does that mean? What would that have done? What would that have been?
They could have done numerous things. They could have given him, you know, it could have led to him replacing Shane McMahon, or, I mean, they wanted to make Kennedy a top, top guy, and aligning him with the McMahon family was part of that, and they just changed their mind with him. I mean, okay. Kennedy did not have a good summer of 2007. He was coming off a suspension at this point with the signature pharmacy bust, okay, after he went on all those talk shows in the summer talking about how the locker room is not what you think, we're all clean, and he was not. So, anyway, Hornswoggle gets the coveted spot of being the younger McMahon. So Great Khali, accompanied by Ranjan Singh. Singh says that this is a sanctioned match, as Charles Robinson then goes to explain the rules. And then we got this big chant of, "We want Shaq." And then Shaq stood up to acknowledge the chant, and Vince clearly got upset here, and he cut a promo on the fans for chanting for Shaquille O'Neal, basically telling them, shut the fuck up and pay attention to what I've promoted in the ring. JBL says he's versed in hand-to-knee combat, in reference to the Great Khali and Hornswoggle's size disparity. Hornswoggle starts hitting him with leg kicks, not very effective here. Maybe this was where Cecil Peoples got his education here, watching Hornswoggle not doing much with these leg kicks. Then, out of nowhere, Hornswoggle had the green mist right into the face of Ranjan Singh and then hit a Fez press off the steps to the floor. Hornswoggle then goes under the ring, grabs a shillelagh. Khali tosses it away, slaps Hornswoggle, goes for the Khali vice grip, but Fit Finlay runs in with his own shillelagh and attacks Khali for a disqualification. At 3 minutes and 15 seconds, kicks Khali low, and then attacks Singh and takes Hornswoggle away. What a horrendous piece of garbage.
Yeah. I think, though, children really like Hornswoggle. I try to think why they still employ him. I'm guessing he's very well liked backstage, but I think he also hits with the younger demographic. So how do you think a child would have liked this match?
I don't know. I just, they would say, like, you know, he's a children's character and stuff. I don't know if kids really dig Hornswoggle or not. Maybe more of a case could be made in 2007 where he was a newer character. By this point, I don't think anyone's tuning in or tuning out of Raw because of Hornswoggle. He's just kind of there. Interestingly enough, paired with the Great Khali, who were actually traveling partners, and that was kind of the story here. Corderis used to ride with them. So you had Khali and Hornswoggle, which, There's your WWE.com exclusive.
Yeah.
Those two traveling together.
There's your next TV show.
Yeah. They showed Alfonso Soriano of the Chicago Cubs in the crowd, as well as Johnny Damon of the Yankees. And then they show a video for the WWE title match. It featured Orton getting out of his match with Shawn Michaels at the Cyber Sunday pay-per-view by kicking him low for the DQ. And then the original angle, when Orton took Michaels out of action with a punt kick. So we fast forward to today, Way, and the punt to Big Show, and he worked the next night.
But with concussive effects.
With concussive effects.
Yeah.
But he's got a stronger head than Shawn Michaels, apparently.
Yeah.
So Orton and Shawn Michaels for the WWE title. The storyline for this is that the super kick is banned. This is also Shawn Michaels' last shot at the title, and if Randy Orton gets disqualified, he loses the title. You got all that?
Yes.
I was kind of, at first, I kind of didn't like the stip, because to me, I always enjoy Shawn Michaels' matches of how it builds to the super kick, and they aired this elaborate video package about all the TV shows where Michaels caught Orton with the super kick, and they showed 4 instances of him catching him with it. 5.
Yeah.
So then the matches, well, the super kick doesn't matter.
So on paper, it sounded like it could have been a terrible idea, but I will.
But it actually got them to be creative.
Yeah, which is the entire point of stipulations in the first place. Shawn did a tremendous, tremendous job of using these limitations to their advantage.
Michaels started off the match applying this cravat. He held on to this thing for 2 minutes and 20 seconds.
The story, though, of course, is that I was a little confused off the top because I knew that Shawn wasn't allowed to use the sweet chin music, but it seemed like they were kind of trying to tell a story that he couldn't, he had to wrestle. Like, he had to, like, keep everything ground-based, which really wasn't the case.
No.
But regardless, I really enjoyed this huge, long segment. I mean, for the first, I'd say, like...
It was so different.
8 minutes of this match, it was just a story of Shawn working various headlocks and Orton doing whatever he can to try to shake Shawn off and not being able to do so. And I thought the two of them, Shawn especially, were very convincing and very realistic in how they were able to do that. And I was especially impressed with Shawn because it's a style that this veteran not usually doesn't usually employ, but did a great job at it.
There was a point where Michaels teased the super kick, and Orton kind of clinched up, but then Michaels just stopped and chopped him instead. Michaels hit applied a front headlock, and then using knees to a downed opponent way.
Well, it's not sanctioned.
Why not? Athletic contest here. Where's the commission?
Well, you can also throw opponents over the top rope here.
I guess, yeah, you're right. You can't do that.
Yeah.
Michaels hit an Asahi moonsault to the floor onto Orton. Looked beautiful.
Yeah.
Michaels then applied the sharpshooter. This was our lone reference to the 97 Survivor Series.
And this was...
Looked terrible.
Well, it was fine. It wasn't like...
He was losing his legs.
Yeah, it wasn't as bad as the Rock's, but...
We've seen worse, but this was not a well-executed, pardon the pun.
Probably not. But I like the sharpshooter, first of all, for nostalgic purposes, obviously, on the 10th anniversary of Montreal. But also, it logically fit into this match where Shawn couldn't use the super kick.
Orton gets the advantage after a draping DDT, and then Michaels comes back, hits two scoop slams, the top rope elbow. I thought the announcers were great here,
yeah,
saying how the sweet chin music is usually next, as Michaels is setting up for it. The referee is warning him that you'll be disqualified.
And Shawn just says, I don't care.
Yeah, and Orton is shielding himself, and then Michaels gets a small package for a two count.
He basically used the stomping with the sweet chin music to tease and psych out Orton.
This match was really, really well laid out, yeah. And this match could have fell flat on its face.
Yeah.
Then Michaels applied the Crippler Crossface, and I remember seeing this, and this is the lone memory I have of the 2007 Survivor Series, because this was only a few months after the Benoit deal. It was the first time they had done the crossface on TV, and this would become a staple for Michaels here and there after this. This, to me, kind of just took me out of the match.
Yeah.
Because it reminded everyone of this really fresh event that was not a happy moment. And I thought this was a complete mistake to put this particular spot in, because to me, it took me right out of the match. At that time.
Yeah.
It's not as jarring today to watch, but in 2007 at that point, I just thought it was a poor choice of submissions.
Well, here's the thinking. They have a match here, which you can essentially call a submission match, basically. Shawn can't use the sweet chin music, so he has to rely to other moves, in particular submissions, to try to get the victory. And their thinking is they only have a limited number of submissions that are over with their WWE audience to choose from. And that, to me, like, basically, anytime you have one of these, it's always, I don't know, a figure four, a sharpshooter, what else? Like, now I guess you got the armbar, crippler crossface. Like, it's a handful of moves that they only have to choose from. The ankle lock. And to me, it just shows how much room there still is for creativity in getting submissions over.
Yeah.
That there still is.
We would see that later wrestling. In the show, actually, with submissions and that kind of educational process.
Yeah, but I mean, unfortunately, even to this day, there are so few submissions that are actually over with this audience. This is all they have to choose from. And, you know, even going as far as to choose the crippler crossface, just even to bring it up right now brings back a lot of terrible memories of all the news stories that came out.
Like, it's not just the fact that it was the move most associated with Chris Benoit, but the fact that when the reports came out,
yeah,
of how his son died, like, I'm beyond baffled at this decision to use this spot. And then you hear Ross saying, Orton is being tortured while he's in this crossface. Mm-hmm. This is just, it was too... completely took me out of the match, and even kind of annoyed me going back and watching this here, this six-year-old event.
Yeah.
I understand what you're saying about, but to me, this was way worse than just a crowd not reacting to a submission. This was like, you could tell this crowd was really, like, weirded out by this. They didn't know how to react to this.
Right.
This, so fresh in people's memories, was Chris Benoit, and that's exactly what it brought people back to.
Absolutely. Yeah, I do agree. And to me, it's just like epidemic of them not having enough moves that are over. But still, you're right. That's, to me, I think this did more harm than good for the quality of the match.
Orton would reach the ropes, and then Orton takes Michaels out with a clothesline. He goes for the punt, playing off the angle that they had shot, but his leg gets caught, and Michaels applies the ankle lock into a heel hook, and he wasn't letting go away. Going all Husamar Paul Harris. And then Michaels gets sent into the corner post. Orton goes for an RKO attempt. It's blocked. And then they transition again. On the second attempt, Orton hits it.
Well, hold on a second. Sean, they do a bunch of reversals. Sean is about to deliver the sweet chin music. He lifts up his leg but stops short. And that's when Orton hits him with the RKO.
It's like he froze as he remembered what he was doing. He was like lost in the match.
Yeah.
Really cool finish, I thought.
Yeah.
And Orton wins clean at 17:48. You take out the crossface, I really, really enjoyed this match.
And you know what, like, I mean, the whole crossface thing, I know some people might get on our cases for being a bit too, this might seem like nitpicking or what. Like, I know a lot of people don't follow the news, maybe they aren't really as closely associated with the whole scenario as maybe you and I are.
I think
maybe
a lot of people, they'll watch wrestling and it's like, outside stuff is kind of shut off and they're just going to enjoy wrestling. And that's fine if you want to do that. I don't, though. It's like, to me, and especially at this time when it had just happened that summer.
Yeah. For me, it was just more of a visceral, personal reaction to seeing something like that. And of all the wrestling moves that are out there, I think there are much better options to choose than that particular one.
So after the match, Orton is slapping Michaels around, demanding that Michaels tell him that he's the best. And he turns around to get the title and just eats this incredibly well-timed super kick that looked like it killed Orton. Yeah. And he lands on his head, essentially, with his eyes frozen open upon landing.
Yeah.
It was like a millimeter away from being too goofy how he sold it, but it was just right, I thought.
I thought Orton was great. I thought Sean was great, too.
It was awesome.
He's just so good at the details, like, you know, looking like he's barely alive, and then all of a sudden snapping into it with that kick, and then going right back to the state where he's barely alive and not even able to stand. I thought this was really well laid out, especially at the end. Crowd leaves home happy, seeing this guy get super kicked. I mean, this, you know, like we mentioned, on paper, this could have seemed like a really bad idea for a stipulation, but Sean really made it work. Great teasing of the super kick throughout the match. That grappling sequence off the top, I thought was really cool, too, to see somebody like Sean work. And, you know, basically using these limitations that were given to them to create dramatic effect, which I think are the point of stipulations in the first place.
Yeah, and you know, 9 times out of 10, I hate when they do the post-match, guy gets his heat back and kind of negates the finish, but I didn't feel that was the case in this match. It's like, Orton beat him, it was a mental slip-up by Michaels, and he got the super kick in after, but you still felt that Orton, you know, Orton beat him.
And Sean was still laid out, like, Sean delivered the kick, but went right back to selling afterwards.
Yeah, I just thought this was well laid out, and this really made me miss having Shawn Michaels as a regular performer.
Honestly, like,
the guy was
one
just
of the best, if not the best ever.
Just incredible, incredible performer, and it's watching stuff like this. I will take his post 2002 career over his pre 2002 career because he just such a
and you
so
the,
many little details
and you take the ego out of it too, you know, and you I mean,
yeah, it's like this guy during that whole stretch from 2002 till 2010. He won a world title and kept it for 3 weeks in that time span.
He was beyond it by that point.
Yeah.
He didn't need the title.
Didn't at all need it. They showed one of the Breaking the Code promos because Jericho would return the following night on Raw and start a program with Randy Orton. So that's what they were building to there. And then we got the main event video package here. The culmination of the Batista-Undertaker feud that had started at WrestleMania that year. And playing off of the last pay-per-view, Cyber Sunday, where Batista, for the first time in his career, pinned The Undertaker. And they play up how this will be a life-defining moment, and you will tell your kids about this match.
What were your expectations going in? Because they had a great WrestleMania match, and this was the rubber match in the series of three.
I was never super high on Batista, but after, I mean, he had some good matches with Triple H, and then when he worked with Undertaker, you really saw that there is a level above this guy just being your generic big guy. Like, that was certainly, I think that Undertaker match at WrestleMania was really a turning point for him, where you didn't know what kind of match it would be, and they gelled really well together. At the same time, they had done this match quite a bit at this time, and it was kind of, like, going back and watching this, they really presented this as a big feud, and I can't say it felt like it was this, you know, gigantic feud at the time. But nonetheless, it was, well laid out, and they made this match feel like a blow-off. I thought the announcers did a really good job in this match.
Yeah, Cole,
really selling Cole this, like, JBL. This is it. This is the end.
It was Cole and JBL not really doing anything too gimmicky or joking around too much about rich people in the Hamptons. Like, it was them being very serious about this match and its consequences.
The match started off. It's a Hell in a Cell here for the world title. Batista defending the title against Undertaker. Started with a very, very fast pace, with Undertaker going for a choke slam that got blocked. He gets a chair, but speared by Batista. Then Taker puts the chair on the throat of Batista, runs it into the steps, and this leads to Batista bleeding from the mouth.
Do you think, how did they do that, with a cap?
Yeah. Usually they'll put just like, some guys, they'd have like a condom full of, whatever. Fake blood.
A condom?
They used to use condoms.
And what do they
bite
do with
down.
What do they do with a condom?
They put it in their mouth and they bite down.
Yeah, I know. What do they do with the used condom?
Well, they just leave a used bloody condom somewhere.
How weird would that be to see a bloody condom in the middle of a wrestling
match? Yeah, it's wrestling way. It happens. Taker goes for the old school.
How weird would it be to find a bloody condom even in the trash? That's disgusting.
Well,
a bloody broken condom.
Whose bloody condom is this? The animal's.
It's Batista's.
Yeah, just fuck the dead man. Undertaker goes for the old school, but it gets countered by a spinebuster. Batista's on offense, sending Taker into the cell on the floor. Taker attacks him with a chair. Batista's bleeding from the forehead at this point as well. And then Batista goes for a superplex and climbs over. And Taker recovers and applies a triangle, which got crickets.
Yeah.
And this was amazing, Way, because this was when they were introducing it, and this would turn out to be the finish at next year's WrestleMania, and by that point, the crowd went nuts for that spot,
right?
Because they train people, and it started off, no one reacted to it.
Well, I heard the announcer say that he managed to beat the Great Khali with it. But even that...
It took a while.
Yeah.
No one reacted to this as a finish.
And, you know, this goes back to what we were saying with the Shawn match, of how few submissions were actually given the time to be over in the WWE.
And they didn't, going into the show, it's not like they were having Shawn go out there and beat guys with submissions. And that's
why he had to use established submissions that other guys used.
Yeah.
But this triangle was something completely new that was being introduced to pro wrestling, and audience at this point definitely didn't react to it.
Batista attacks Taker with the steps on the floor, so Taker is now also busted open. Taker goes for the last ride out of the corner, only gets a two count. He chokeslams him for another two count, and then a spinebuster by Batista gets a two count. Batista pulls out a table into the ring, powerbombs Taker through it for a two count, and nearly didn't get him up enough here for this powerbomb. Taker back body drops Batista onto the steps, and then a tombstone is delivered to Batista, who kicks out at two from the tombstone. So then the Undertaker gets the steel steps, and he tombstones Batista onto the steps, and the referee counts one, two, and then referee Mickey Henson is pulled out of the ring by Edge, who's at ringside. Dressed as the cameraman. He takes the camera and lays out the Undertaker with the camera.
I love this. Like, I don't know if it's been done before. I feel like it has, like the cameraman gimmick.
They did it at a Survivor Series once in '96, where Sid got the camera and attacked Jose Lothario and Shawn Michaels with it.
Sid wasn't dressed.
No, he was in the match though. He was in the match.
I mean, the idea that anybody within ringside could be a pro wrestler in disguise, I think, so simple but like so brilliant.
So it's the big surprise return of Edge. And it wasn't like Edge, like, this is his first time back since July. You'd think would get, like, the momentary pop because it's a surprise. But this guy, instant heel.
How did he leave?
He had torn his pec.
And was he babyface or heel?
He was a heel at the time when he left. Okay. But they just instantly hated this guy for...
Well, he ruined an amazing match.
He did. And So Taker is laid out with this shot with the camera. Then Taker's head is put on the steps, and Edge delivers a concerto and places Batista on top of the Undertaker, and the referee counts three, 21 minutes, 25 seconds, and Edge is back here, and this would lead to the alliance being formed between Edge and Vicky Guerrero on the following SmackDown coming out of this pay-per-view, and I thought the a good ending. It was a kind of a way out of, you know, kind of trying to protect the Undertaker here. I can see how some people negative to a run-in finish in a Hell in a Cell, but it did kind of bring a semi-end to the feud.
It was, a run-in finish to Hell in a Cell, but I thought at the very least a creative run-in that was very plausible. And, like, I think I'm fine with, like, fucked finishes, but at least be creative when you do it, you know what I mean? And I thought this was one of those. I liked this match a lot. I thought both men were using their strengths as heavyweights, basically their ability to lift heavy things and, you know, attack each other with it, to their advantage. I thought everything that they tried to pull off was pulled off very well. I thought Batista's blade job looked excellent, and it far exceeded my expectations.
Batista, I think, sometimes gets a bad rap. You know, when he was in there with certain guys, I mean, I think he sometimes gets underrated in terms of a guy that could put together a well-worked match, and those Undertaker matches were certainly evidence of that, and he would also have good matches with Triple H. Those ones would stand out as well. So, anyway, that was the Survivor Series 2007. At this time, we're going to go back to the November 18th, 2007 edition of Live Audio Wrestling, where Dan Lavransky and Jason Agnew welcomed on Dave Meltzer from the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. So we'll go for their thoughts on the show the night of Survivor Series 2007.
As we like to do every Sunday night at this time, we welcome Dave Meltzer, the editor of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. Dave, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing okay. Big week.
It certainly was. A lot of stuff. two big pay-per-views we got to talk about. We'll start with Survivor Series, obviously. No real big Montreal ribs or anything. I mean, Michaels used a sharpshooter, as we kind of guessed he would. But they didn't really shove it in our faces or anything this time, Dave.
Well, you know what? I think it's over and done with. I think that when, you know, they're negotiating for Bret Hart's book.
Right.
And I think that, and another DVD, and I think that Bret Hart, in that sense, he's on their team again.
Right.
You know, whether he thinks so or not, they think he's on their team. And why rub, you know, all that is their grudge from all those years. Well, you know, to me, as soon as he came back, and I noticed this from the Hall of Fame on, as soon as that happened, they really haven't been doing the Montreal stuff anymore.
Right.
Like, I think that Vince doesn't have any need to get back on a guy who's back with him. It's like with Austin. You know what I mean? As soon as Austin came back, you know, there were no more hit pieces on Austin. When Hogan comes back, there'll be no more hit pieces on Hogan.
Right. Now, one thing that did surprise me, though, in the Michaels match, him using the crossface. I just figured after what happened with Benoit and their constant attempts to kind of erase him from their history, that a move like that would have been, you know, banned.
Boy, it really surprised me.
And it's not like he just did it momentarily.
I think that they did it to test out what would happen, and you know, the people popped for it. You didn't hear people booing.
No, that's true.
So I think it was the way to introduce it, and now they'll, you know, it's a move that got over, and you know, it's easier to get it to do a move that gets over than Undertaker still trying to get that triangle over. And he does in every match, and like people just go quiet, and he even beat Kali with it, and the people still go quiet.
Yeah, that's for sure. I think there wasn't enough build up of him using it to win matches. I think when you see him win match with it out of the blue like that, I don't think anybody's going to buy it. What about the return of Edge? I thought that was handled fairly well. Really, I figured that would be the best way to bring him back. And really, it shows the WWE has kind of stumbled on a good way to go about letting people know that someone's going to be there without directly saying it.
Yeah, I like that finish a lot, you know, because, you know, I'm watching the whole show and I'm going like, God, Edge isn't going to be there. You know what I mean? After you kind of were told that he was going to come back, even though, again, you can't say, but they never advertised it, so you can't say anything.
But I thought by putting him so prominently in the ads, the seed is planted.
Absolutely.
So, like, it's really kind of, you're getting around that issue of revealing it too soon and still keeping it as a surprise.
Yeah, I thought that was great. I thought it was great how it was done, and I know that they've been wanting to do Undertaker and Edge for WrestleMania for a long time, and I don't know that that's what they're going to do, but
that would,
you know,
be the logical plan, yes.
Yeah. So again, it was a way for Undertaker to lose without losing again in Hell in a Cell,
right?
You know? And so, you know, I thought I thought that finish, and it was a great match, too.
Yeah, I thought so. Now, one match where I thought had real great potential to get continue one of the best angles going right now, and that's MVP and Matt Hardy. I thought that for sure that Survivor Series match, especially with the tease of Hardy being out, I thought for sure they're all going to get eliminated, MVP's going to be left, and Hardy's going to come down, and they're going to have a match, and it would keep that program going. But instead, it was just a generic match on the card.
I was surprised that, like, Hardy didn't limp to ringside and, like, hit him over the head with a crutch.
Right.
You know, to eliminate him. You know, because it's like...
Because he's not legitimately hurt, right?
No, he's not legitimately hurt. He's not legitimately hurt, and he was at the house show the night before, and I was of the impression he was going to do something at the show, but I think that they just made the call, you know, well, maybe to save it for TV or... You know, it just
seemed like a great chance to make that match mean something. And because really, that feud has been one of the best feuds this year. And I just felt they just turned it into kind of a generic match that really meant nothing.
Yeah, agreed.
And of course, with the Hornswoggle Kali thing
that was worse than I thought. I was expecting it to be. that was brutal.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. Absolutely. There you go. All right, let's move on a little bit here. We will talk about the UFC one, but I want to get a couple other wrestling things in here. We heard the news a couple of days. It looks like the U.S. government's finally going to look into steroids when they come back after the break in February. I know the focus is going to be baseball and stuff, Dave, but are we finally going to get what we've wanted for so long now?
I don't know. What do we want? I mean,
I just want something to put in place that we don't have to see guys die every 3 weeks or something, you know?
I just don't know that we're going to get that ever.
Right.
I don't know. I don't have confidence in that. I don't know. I don't know. I just don't know that. You know, the thing is, it's like the issues in wrestling, people really do know. I mean, I was always afraid they wouldn't be able to figure it out, but the people in these committees, you know, it's been out in the news enough and kind of like the whole mentality of there. And it's not to get Vince, it's to get people healthy. You know, and I don't trust people in wrestling. I trust that they'll come to a compromise with wrestling people who will all agree to do something. But I just think when the heat dies down, it's going to always go back to how it was, because I remember in the early 90s, you know, when there was all that heat and everybody was, you know, I mean, WCW and WWF were both going to clean it up. And, you know, and they did some lip service, and WWF even did clean it up. But then, eventually, when the heat
yeah,
died
disappeared,
down, it went
yeah.
right back to what it was. And I just feel like no matter what happens, it's just this inevitability that it's going to go back to how it was unless they have a governmental agency test them, you know, like a commission, in which case then, you know, then they'll have to clean up more.
Right. We're talking to Dave Meltzer, the editor of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter, and you're listening to Live Audio Wrestling on Fight Network Radio. A couple of big returns, it looks like, in the next while. I'm suspecting tomorrow night's the big Jericho return.
Sure seems that way.
Yep, the promos are saying tomorrow night, and that I think if it's not tomorrow night, fans are going to be really
People
disappointed.
Will be mad. I
yep.
think so, yeah.
Yeah. And the other one, Dave, Ric Flair coming back at Raw next week in Charlotte. Is that what we're hearing?
That there's an advertisement that I saw that the building put out that lists Ric Flair on the card. I have checked around, and what I can only tell you is that as of a few days ago, Ric Flair did not know when he was coming back, but it makes sense that it would be Charlotte.
Totally.
And he is coming back. I mean, it's not, you know, they whatever problems they had, they worked out
mm-hmm.
you know, a week or two ago. So it makes sense, you know, that would be the place, but I can't say 100%, but I expect it.
Right, and are we still going to get an angle with him kind of, you know, building up a streak, building towards a title match at Mania or something
I don't know. My gut tells me we won't, just because there's, you know, the whole political thing of people, you know, some people know the angle, so we can't do it.
Right.
And people know that it wasn't Vince's idea, it was Steve Austin's idea. So now I think that because of that, maybe they can't do it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's that ego thing.
Mm-hmm.
So my gut tells, you know, I don't know. My gut tells me they probably will do something different.
So there you go. Dave Meltzer, editor of the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. Now, do you remember that show?
Yes.
Now that you've heard it back.
Yeah.
Before we get on out of here, we're going to go over to the feedback thread. A heaping amount of mail this week, Way.
Oh, is that right?
All of three people recall this show. We start off with Caesar, who writes, I hold the 2007 Survivor Series as probably my second favorite Survivor Series behind the 2005 show. 2007 was definitely the year of The Undertaker and Batista. I loved every single match of theirs from that year, and the Hell in a Cell was another great chapter in their rivalry. The finish of the match was kind of spoiled because leading into the show, Edge was being heavily advertised for the show, so you knew that he would get involved in this match. The traditional tag match was really good and was the last show that the Survivor Series tag team match had a good build leading in and really meant something, unlike the past 3 years where the match was announced on the go-home show. My favorite match from this show was the Orton-Michaels match. I thought it had a great build where HBK couldn't use the move that he kept using against Orton week after week, told a great story of Shawn having to rely on moves that he never used before, and it played out great during the match. However, at the time, it was kind of awkward seeing the crossface 4 months after the death of Benoit. Overall, this was probably the last great Survivor Series that the WWE has had to offer, as the next couple of years, it started becoming more like the other shows rather than the Big Four. He gives this a 9 out of 10, so a fondly remembered show by Caesar.
Christian Small, I forgot how good the show was until I watched it again. There was only really two downsides to the show for me. The Divas tag, which you knew was going to have problems when Melina slipped during her entrance. But that match had two things I liked. The first was all the heels were in black and red, so they matched. And the second was JR went over how many titles the heels had won compared to who the faces were dating at the time. The other bad moment was the entire Great Khali Hornswoggle thing, which lasted way too long for nothing. It scares me that WWE are said to be looking at another Indian giant who is actually taller than Khali. Besides those two matches, I really liked the show. The Triple Threat was a good opener. The Elimination match helped make Jeff Hardy look like a star. Both title matches were fantastic. I love the story in the WWE title match. Thankfully, Orton is a better wrestler than Promo, as he messed up earlier in the night. And I did find it funny that Shawn wasn't able to apply one submission correctly in this match. The Hell in a Cell match was a good way to end a great feud between Taker and Batista and showed how a Hell in a Cell should be used. Overall, really liked the show and feel like it has become forgotten over time for how good it was. I give it 8 out of 10.
And finally, Gaurav from India. This was an entertaining pay-per-view. WWE had a nice and talented depth in their roster even in 2007. CM Punk never really felt like a star back then, at least to me. But 4 years later in 2011, I became the biggest fan of Punk after his pipe bomb promo. The backstage interview of Team Triple H was hilarious. The fact that Kane brought up the Katie Vick thing was awesome. Not many people give Triple H any credit for his comedy, but his comedic timing is underrated. What a treat to watch Khali as a monster heel. This was back when he actually mattered and played a significant role on SmackDown. Funny how Michaels came back in 2002 and retired in 2010, and in those 8 years, he won the championship only once inside the Elimination Chamber. Do you guys have any ideas to why they never put the title on Michaels after his last championship reign in 2002? Well, we went over it. I am with you, Wei. I don't think he really needed it. There was never the need to do it. I mean, at that point, too, he was, you know, taking sporadic breaks. You know, he wasn't going with a completely full schedule. And I think that, you know, at that time you were really focusing on John Cena and Batista and building those new stars, and Michaels really didn't need the title.
Didn't need the title. The title was better served as a gimmick for somebody that needed it, like maybe a John Cena at the time. And also, I think, you know, like, Shawn never took the role of, you know, that face of the company, quote-unquote, that, you know, they usually reserve for the guy with the title. He was always just sort of, at this point, the guy, not always in the main event, but in the bottom lower half, who was there to elevate guys, who was there to have great matches to bring up the work rate on the show.
All right, so that'll wrap up the Survivor Series 2007. What did you give the show out of a 10?
I give it an 8 out of 10, and mainly for the last two matches, which I was very impressed by.
Yeah, I'll go with a 7. Yeah, both title matches I thought really delivered on this show. There was Khali and Hornswoggle, but that was really short, but not every pay-per-view is going to be excellent. So there you go. Those were our thoughts. Thank you for your feedback. You can always post your thoughts on all the shows we do at lawradio.proboards.com. That's also where you can get all the information. Our contest is winding down to win a WWE 2K14 video game for Xbox 360.
You have one more day.
One more day. We're going to be going through all the entries Thursday night on Review and Impact, picking two finalists that will compete on Title Bout Trivia this Sunday night on Live Audio Wrestling. As we get on out of here, Wei, do you have a selection for next week? Is there something you want to review? No, you do not. Okay, well, let's think here.
Do you want to do the WWE documentary the history of the WWE?
Sure, let's do that. It recently came out, the WWE's 50th anniversary documentary. Mm-hmm. So we'll take a look at that next week on the show. And as well, we encourage you to post your feedback. And coming up later this week, folks, as we mentioned, Review and Impact, where we will go through both Impact and your submissions in the video contest. The MMA report will be up later this week featuring Juliana Pena and David Grant, finalists on The Ultimate Fighter. Coming up on Saturday night, and then Sunday night on The Law, keeping with the Ultimate Fighter theme, we're going to be joined by Misha Tate as well as Dave Meltzer. So all of that is coming up. You can grab all our shows at liveaudiowrestling.com, subscribe for free on iTunes, Stitcher app, Fight Network app. You're going to say something.
No, I was just going to say that.
I feel like Joe Rogan.
Yeah, like, have you ever thought about recording this portion and just playing it back?
Oh, because I say it over and over again all the time? Well, maybe I should... Maybe that's a great idea. Oh, that does sound like more work than is necessary.
Maybe
we should take turns. Who's more effective at?
No, you're way more effective.
No. I think you would be. I think people because you, I've got to be the guy that just shoves stuff
do
down
it.
People's throats. So when you do it, it's special. You recommend a show, it's like, okay, I better check it out.
Well, I don't.
I'm white noise to people.
I don't remember most of what's even on our own feed, so I don't think I can.
Okay. Well, also check out What's Next. That'll be up Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of great shows to check out. So we are going to get on out of here. We will chat with you next week, and we're going to go out with some music that I think I've had this song stuck in my head all week. So I know we're a little late to the dance here, but this has just been
how are you going to tie
consuming
this
me.
How are you going to tie this into the show?
Because
it's got to be related. You can do it. Come on.
Well, you know what? Maybe I will consult the current WWE Divas division to get their thoughts on this 2007 Survivor Series match. And in fact, the person I most would want to know their thoughts on would be Alicia. And see what the Fox has to say about this 2007 Divas match.
Dog goes woof, cat goes meow, bird goes tweet, and mouse goes squeak. Cow goes moo, frog goes croak, and the elephant goes toot. Ducks say quack, and fish go blub, and the seal goes ow, ow, ow. There's no sound that no one knows. What does the fox say? Digging holes, tiny paws up the hill. Suddenly you're standing still. Your fur is red, so beautiful, like an angel in disguise. But if you meet a friendly horse, will you communicate by more? How will you speak to that? What does the frog say? The fuck?